Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about, let me see what I need to do. Dealing with our kind of borrowing rule, mentioning that, well, that there's a bunch of situations that doesn't handle. How do we deal with that? And we saw that Rust, along with some other languages, provides these kind of escape hatches, which allow us to have these policies that are implemented mostly outside the compiler. And kind of a key mechanism for that was we had these, what I call smart pointer types, because smart pointers are the terms you'll see used all the time in C++ for this, where we can kind of borrow a normal reference or pointer from this smart pointer type normally. And in Rust, there's actual enforcement that that borrowed reference doesn't escape and become something that kind of invalidates the policy we're trying to set. But we can run code when the pointer's created or copied or destroyed, this smart pointer that is, that implements some more complicated policy. And we looked at a couple examples of that. So we talked about cell was kind of more built into the compiler, giving us a modifiable part of an immutable value. But this was kept safe according to our borrowing rules by only allowing copies out. So we didn't have any borrowing happening. So we didn't have to worry about, were there two readers? Were we reading while someone was writing? Not possible. We had ref cell, which extended this to allow kind of references to be taken out. But to do that, we wanted to make sure that we weren't modifying something while it was being read, because we had problems like, what if our array was resized? We'd have a reallocation of memory, we'd have a use after free bug potentially. And RefCell's solution for dealing with this was adding runtime overhead. That they did runtime bookkeeping to track the number of readers and writers and enforce the only one writer at a time rule. We also talked about RC. This was solving the problem where we had a bunch of things that wanted to read the same value, but then we have a question of, well, when does the value actually go away? We want to make sure it doesn't go away while anyone is potentially using it. And RC solves this problem with reference counting, which you mentioned is a very common solution to this. There's a bunch of programming languages where it's kind of done by default for everything. So to do this, we have this extra bookkeeping of the number of pointers to it. And in Rust, we know that when we get a normal reference, there's a corresponding smart pointer its value borrowed from. So we know that that reference count is never too low by accident, which in systems which do reference counting in like C or C++ is a relatively common bug pattern. I also should probably talk about the quiz. If I find my quiz, yes. So quiz question 3 was asking for this code, which of these things could follow our single owner rule? And we have a problem here that the attendees are presumably referenced for multiple calendar entries, so the attendees don't. You know, it probably wouldn't make sense to have an attendee be unique for calendar entry. And our document, that might only be referenced from one calendar entry, so that might be fine. We don't know for sure from this information, but it's consistent that it could be fine. You know, we could have a rule that work makes sense for that. And we have our calendar that our attendees have. Like, presumably, you know, if we have one calendar per attendee, so maybe the calendar is unique per an attendee, so that might make sense. I believe that's the answers I got this document in. Calendar. Calendar entry is probably because each attendee has a calendar referenced by multiple calendars. And that makes sense because we want to have one document for that. And the document ops doesn't make sense because it probably wouldn't make sense to have a separate copy of this for each document. And we also tell you that there are several instances that are stored in global variables. So even if that would make sense, we're not doing that. Maybe this question, I'll talk to my TAs what they think about grading. The other thing I noticed is I forgot to write select all that apply here, and I did not. But that I could potentially fix in grading after the fact, just how this is graded. But questions on the quiz? Yeah.
Question, sorry.
Sure.
Why would calendar and calendar entry apply? Because, I mean, if you did a struct for calendar and calendar entry, sorry, I'm scrolling up. Since, if you write the right value calendar entry at, say, end time, then you can control the first entry of the calendar and the entries array in calendar.
If you write the right value to calendar,
end time,
we can control the first entry. I agree with that. The problem, this is for three. The problem is how do we execute a function after that?
I mean, since we can control the value of that, since entry is the entry at zero, for example, is address. So we can make that address be another location in the bucket.
Okay. Oh, I guess your proposal is that we eventually get a document?
Yes.
Okay, I agree. That is possible to do. It's definitely a lot more complicated, but that is definitely actually possible. And I probably will just drop that option. Since useful is kind of vague, it would be possible to do that exploit in that case. So I will Q3 drop. Option A is really correct.
It also works with person B because you can just write your option B. Yeah. Because you can
option D, attendee. What is the pointer? Oh, because we can overwrite the entries array, part of the entries array with email. That's what you're arguing. Okay. Yes, so. So I will get my cursor in the place I want it to be. Option A and D. It's really correct, but a lot more in direction. Direction. Yeah, so I will update that. You are correct that actually all of them are useful, and I should have marked the key that way. Yeah?
Could you also explain why option A would work for question two?
For question two, need to find where I put my. Here. Question two. We want to discover where the application code is loaded. So for question A, calendar entry, we can read the value of these calendar entry pointers, but it's not clear how we get information that clearly gets us to a function pointer, which is what we want to know where the code is loaded, or a global variable. Maybe there's some sequence of things we could do, but it doesn't seem especially likely, because kind of the best we can do with a calendar entries access something that looks like an attendee as a calendar entry, and maybe we can try to get to a calendar that way, but then that seems like we're probably not going to have any more nice coincidences and function and pointers at that point. I believe that answer your question or comment, feedback, follow up. Yeah, question there. I agree that if we have an entry and a calendar entry, we can learn all about the entry pointers from end time and description if we have them coincident.
So would that be useful to learn?
Memory addresses in general, but the problem is that those addresses are probably from memory that's dynamically allocated, which is not going to help us know where the program is living. Is that answer your question? Yeah.
Can you go over question one as well?
Can I go over question one? Sure. So here we want to, we have our values that on our free list that are in this order. And we have some memory allocations that are in the middle of it. And we're going to overwrite one of these memory allocations such that when it is freed, what we want to happen is that we're going to, as part of freeing it, we're going to remove something from the next, from remove one of these blocks from the linked list, not it later. And what's most useful for that is, well, we want to free something that's adjacent to a free block because we want that remove from linked list operation to happen. And we want to be able to overwrite the next and free pointers of the thing that's going to be removed. So you want something that is just before a free block and overwrite to overwrite that free block's next and free pointers. 208 doesn't let us do that because the next block is not free. Yes, we're overwriting something, but that's not especially useful. C is not useful because we're not overwriting a thing that's used at the correct time. Like, it's not clear. We're going to replace the pointers, next and free pointers anyways. We might mess up the size, which is might be convenient for C because we can overwrite the size, but it's not clear how we turn that as easily into an exploit as B. And writing here, this is writing to free space that's going to be overwritten anyways. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so just to clarify, so in B we're trying to overwrite the 3,320 byte region.
Yeah.
Correct? And in A, what's the goal of trying to access 208? Which one are we trying to overwrite?
So in A, we're overwriting the size and the beginning of the next region of this reason.
Okay.
Which isn't very useful because it's not going to, because there aren't any next and free pointers stored in there currently. So we're overwriting a size, that might be useful, but we're not overwriting any pointers. And it's much more convenient if we're overwriting pointers. I think that's probably the point of confusion. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay. And I see when I'm writing quiz questions on, is this use after free exploitable? I need to think very hard because it is more often than I thought. Yeah.
Could you explain how option C for question two works?
Option C for question two? So with attendee, the name is the, if we can set the name of an attendee, we can set the document operations pointer. So if we have enough information about an address of a buffer we control, it's sufficient to redirect calls on that document. Does that answer your question? Questions. Yeah, and I guess there's like a bunch of little caveats going here, which is like to make all this work, not only do we need to like, you know, have these use after free, we also need like the address we're overwriting we can express as a name somehow that, you know, such that the ASCII lines up with the pointer value. So it won't always actually be exploitable in practice, and even more so for the much more indirect exploits, where we make a pointer to another pointer to another pointer scenario. Okay. Also, there's a REST assignment out. I'll do Q&A today and Wednesday on it because it's new and I'm worried about it. I'm trying to get the right balance of not just making it a intro programming in REST assignment, but also not making it pointer hell. So our main topic for today is going to be on what I plan to be the next assignment, which is on testing. And I believe, based on syllabi I've seen, that 3710 usually discusses basic fuzz testing. And so we're going to talk about an extension of this idea. And we're going to have an assignment using a tool that does quote-unquote white box or gray box fuzz testing. So for testing, there's two, I think, kind of big challenges with testing for security. The other, one thing is that the security bugs use these unrealistic inputs that are hard to come up with. So often, our normal software testing process will not find the security bug inputs. The other is that sometimes there's a security bug and it doesn't reliably trigger a crash. We're going to assume that we have tools that fix this. So I think if you've taken CS01, hopefully you've maybe vaguely remember being introduced to address sanitizer as an example of such a tool. And this is kind of example address sanitizer. This is compiler adds is pointer inbounds checks to all pointer dereferences, essentially. I have planned to talk about how address sanitizer and some competing tools work. The reason why we normally don't run with this is also it makes the code program 3 to 5 times slower. Plus, a lot more memory. So the tools like Address Sanitizer, and we'll talk about some others, but there's a reason we don't use them in production. They have really huge costs. But for testing, that's not such a big deal. And kind of an assumption I would make is that if we're looking for security problems, that usually if we find any sort of crash, we'll assume that's probably a security bug. We've seen that kind of all our memory error causes of crashes are pretty related to security bugs, except maybe null pointer dereferences. But use after free bugs, using uninitialized data, underflows, all have many cases where we kind of need to assume there's going to be a actual exploitable problem. And the basic idea that I believe you've seen in 3710 is sort of just generate a lot of random inputs. You want to test something, just generate tons of random inputs. Great way of testing. This generates all our weird inputs, and then for finding security bugs, we look for memory errors or wrong answers or something going wrong. So as C++ code, right, we make a vector, an array, and we just fill it with random junk and pass it to the function we're testing. So in this example, I have an image library, and I just see, if I pass it random data, does it crash? It should just tell me it's not a real image. Or maybe it is a real image, but it shouldn't crash. And this is a great idea. And it works with unmodified software. It works better if you compile with extra error checking, like address sanitizer. So things that are bugs more consistently turn into crashes. You don't need to understand the input format, which is important because it means that, this code I wrote here, where I just started with some input and flipped a bunch of bits in it randomly, I can do this for any function I write here, try to parse web page. Works the same way. And it's also really easy to parallelize. So if you don't have much people time, but you have a lot of computer time, you can just throw 30 machines at this over a weekend, and probably find a lot of bugs. So there's some problems with this. And the big issue is that this is what I'll call black box, that we can't look inside the program, and we only run it and see if it works. And also, we have to define what it means to works. And for kind of our memory error bugs, that definition is easy. It works if it doesn't crash. For other things, it's a little harder, but people have still applied this technique. So as an example, there's been a bunch of work on verifying C compilers, and they wanted to use fuzz testing. But fuzz testing for C compilers to know if they crash, well, that's useful, but most of the things we're concerned about being wrong with our C compiler isn't it crashing, it's producing the wrong code. How do you tell if the C compiler produces the wrong code? And, well, you know, you need something to compare to. So what they did is they said, well, we have two C compilers. They should produce programs that do the same thing. And that was their strategy. This is not super easy, though, because if we think of a program like this, where I'm printing out the uninitialized variable foo, we don't really care that that might do different things in different compilers, because it's not supposed to work. So they needed to add some extra constraints to their test generation to make this actually practical. But this kind of idea can work nicely in a lot of cases for fuzzing. If you have something where you have other implementations, you can just say, are these the same? And still do random testing and test more than just, does it crash? And there's some other areas where we can apply fuzzing where it might not be so obvious you can do it. So one example is, let's say I want to find cross-site scripting bugs. Fuzzing is a good technique for that, but I'm obviously not checking for a crash. Probably what I check for is, if I get malformed HTML, probably that means someone who's smart, who looks at why it's malformed, can figure out how to turn that into a cross-site scripting problem where we run some script. Or for SQL injection, if I ever get malformed SQL, if the SQL parser ever gives me an error, probably someone who knows what's going on can turn that into an actual SQL injection attack. So we can apply these techniques to these other security problems. Also, we can apply this to cases where it might not be so obvious what's the input here. So for example, people have applied this testing technique to operating systems, where they've just had these system calls, the request applications make to the OS, that be the fuzzed input. So they have applications make a random set of requests to the OS as a way of testing the OS for security bugs. Fuzzing, kind of challenging, but nice, simple technique. We need some problem. We need to detect wrong answers. Another challenge in doing this in practice is to make this, you know, work nicely, you really want it to be reproducible. So if our program, like, depends on the current time, that's pretty bad for fuzzing, right? Our random test case, it might crash, but it won't crash consistently. The other thing is that some of the bugs you'll find will be crashes that are hangs. And you need to have some rule for distinguishing, is the program stuck in an infinite loop, which probably shouldn't be possible. Like, you know, my broken parse image function, some images just take literally forever to parse. Probably we would consider that a low priority security bug. It's a denial of service attack. But how do we, when we're testing, distinguish that from it just taking a while? So we need to, like, be able to set some timeouts. And we also, to make this practical, we want to run like millions of tests. So this means that larger applications, like not so great to fuzz. Right, we want to fuzz small pieces of code. Like we're fuzzing like a whole web browser loading a web page, maybe that's not going to be so great because that takes a little bit of time. And a bigger issue, and the one I'm going to talk about extensions of fuzzing that go well beyond what you saw in 3710, is trying to address this completeness issue, that the input that triggers the interesting bug, we might have to get pretty lucky. With fuzzing, it'll happen eventually, but we kind of won't have it happen by accident very much. And as an illustration, let's say we're testing an HTML parser. So let's say we flip random bits or add bytes. What's usually going to happen? Can someone tell me? So, like, I'm using my strategy. I start with an HTML document, and I make some random changes, and I put that through my parser. I'm trying to find security flaws. What's usually going to happen when I make my random changes? Yeah.
Syntax error.
Yeah. And that's, you know, probably something we want to test, but with fuzzing, you know, if we don't do anything, we're probably going to be testing syntax errors like 99.999% of the time. Maybe not what we want to do. Also, we're almost never probably going to generate a tag that wasn't in the thing we started with and made random changes to. And we're probably almost never going to generate kind of a different, almost valid document. And quite possibly, interesting bugs in our HTML processor would require us to do these things and to not just generate trivial syntax errors. But, you know, that's what we're probably going to end up with, right? Make some random changes. And it's just kind of a silly syntax error. Or, also, we might make changes that, like, don't affect anything, right? A change there is extremely unlikely to do anything. It's not a useful place to test. So, a strategy we can use instead is instead of doing random mutations, we can make a sort of test case, a random test case generator. And in the compiler space, this is something people have done. They just generate random C programs where they're using the same random idea, it's random testing, but rather than just a random sequence of bytes, we kind of write a little code that generates a template for a random, in this case, a C program. We could also imagine doing that for a random HTML document. And then the other thing we can do once we have this sort of thing is that we can also try to simplify our test cases. So let's say we find a C program that triggers a compiler bug or an HTML document that triggers a parser bug. Probably, if we generate it using this random testing technique, it's going to have a lot of random junk in it, literally random junk. That doesn't actually matter for the bug. Something we can do automatically is if we have something that understands what a C program is supposed to look like or an HTML document is supposed to look like, we can try just removing things from the test case and make sure it still triggers a bug and get kind of a minimal example. And this is something that's really useful to do for fuzz testing to make it actually useful, right? Because it's one thing for me to give you, here's a 2 kilobytes of input that causes a crash. Now you software developer fix it versus the minimal example. But this still seems like not very systematic. This is an improvement. So we're going to talk about thinking of tests where we go beyond just looking at kind of program input and output, and look at the actual code of the program we're testing. So, let's say I want to test this function. What should I do to make sure I'm testing it thoroughly? Yeah. So make sure each branch is deleted. So how would I do that in this case?
So each if statement is tested for both true and false.
Okay, so each if statement, both true and false. So let's start with our first if statement. What do we do? What should I do for my test to make that happen? So someone who hasn't gone, maybe? Like, how should I, like, so we'll come up with things that we basically, things we want to be in the test case. So the idea, yeah.
Like, specification of the or, like, what specific?
So his goal is he wanted to test each if statement being true and false. So how do we call this function, test this function to make that happen with our first if statement?
Yeah, so just.
Okay, so we need a test where the first index of the R contains an open bracket, and also we want one where it doesn't. Right, we want to make sure we handle both of those cases. And then we want to kind of repeat that for this process here, that we want to make sure we test a case where the third character, index 2, has a slash. So we come up with this idea that we're going to, like, kind of look at this function, look at the, you know, different branches this function can take, and try to cover them systematically. And this is probably a pretty common strategy for humans trying to test programs. So we're going to want to try to make fuzz testing apply this kind of logic. And try to have fuzz testing, you know, do some looking at the code, do that. And a measurement that we're kind of implicitly optimizing that you will have seen if you've taken various software engineering courses, I hope, is coverage. So the number of lines of code that we execute, that's one way of measuring it, you know, is we want to make sure you reach this line, for example. We want to make sure we have a test case to reach this line and this line. Yeah. And this is something we can automatically find. Now, it's not as good as black box testing because we need the code to do it, but if we have the code, we can measure coverage by just incrementing a covered zero, like a counter for each line, and just looking at those counters. So this is one metric for how good our tests are. And it kind of matches percent of code reached. And it correlates with the number of bugs we'll find. Now, it doesn't mean we found all the bugs. Because for a function like this, right, there's, like, we can reach all the lines, but if there's bugs related to these recursive calls, those might be, reaching all the lines just might not get us quite there. Like, it might matter how that recursion works out. But this is really easy to measure, and there's an idea that we can combine this with fuzz testing to get better fuzz testing without doing sort of much sort of at, you know, human cost. Because this is really easy to measure, you can just automate. So I have a slide that previews a future topic, which I should have adjusted. So what we can do is we can say, let's say we're trying to test this function. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 blocks of code here, W, X, Y, Q, and Z. and I'm going to measure whether those are reached by a test case. So I'm going to assume when I run a test case of this function, where I have two inputs I can control, that I know sort of which parts are reached. And my goal is to construct a test case that reaches a different set of things than I've seen before. So I'll do my usual fuzz testing strategy of making random changes to my inputs. And I'll take this, and eventually I'll find a new useful test case that covers something that isn't covered before. And then I can keep going by, rather than making tests where I make random changes to this initial input here, I'll make them to my initial, my found interesting inputs. So I'll start out with inputs that I know are different in the sense that they run different code, and use that as the basis for all my random tests. And I'll have the goal of noting every case where I discover kind of new ways of running different parts of the code. Questions? Yes. And so this ends up being a much more efficient form of fuzz testing, and it mitigates the problem we saw earlier where we were making changes that didn't matter and kind of working on that, because what we'll do instead is when we make those changes, we'll realize, oh, this kind of isn't useful, let's just not keep going down that route. And when we make a change that might actually be useful, we'll know that we did, that it, you know, it might be worth exploring more. So we can see, for example, here, I have my three inputs, and we just, you know, randomly change values until we find sort of new sets of inputs and keep going. And note something that we want to do in this strategy is that we're not just going to try to run each line of code, we're going to try to run each combination of lines of code. Right? Because it's quite possible that in order to trigger the bug, right, it's not enough to run running W, X, and Y might not trigger a bug, but running W and Y might. So in this example, we're just computing numbers to, you know, kind of show things. But as far as reaching a condition like this, you know, it might matter that we skip that or not. We can kind of account for that. Questions on this coverage-guided testing idea. So, now that we've looked at that, I have three functions here. Where would coverage-guided testing be most an improvement on random testing? Just random, making random tests. So just choosing random values for A and B versus this idea we start with some initial test, mutate them randomly, and try to, you know, reach more things. And I guess there's something we should ask about our coverage. And my assumption is going to be that when we have something like this, that we'll measure the coverage as we'll have an A part, a B part, and a C part, and then a D part. That because if you know in C or Java, when you have double ampersand, like we only execute the next part of the conditional when the first part is true. And the same for the others. So when we're measuring coverage, we'll know how often do we execute the A equals equals B comparison. So who has an opinion on which of these functions is worst for coverage-guided testing? Where are we going to take? Where are we going to have the least good results? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So example two. So coverage helps us none. Is no help. Right. There's no extra information we can extract here. Yeah. So it's not going to help us produce better test cases. We're just going to be generating random test cases based on it reaches the comparison. Yep, does. Yep, there we go. Okay. Yeah.
And then so that would make example one, where coverage is most useful because A and B can be many of the values that
are. So for example one, I think coverage is probably most useful, and I think my intuition would be that this sort of should make us spend less time testing A much greater than 4, for example. Right? That should be pretty rare because we'll realize that that's not getting us down a useful path. Because it's just giving the same result every time we try changing A to a value bigger than 4. Oh, we've already tested this case. So we'll spend hopefully less time there and more time, making changes to A, B less than 4, right? Because we'll start with A, B less than 4 that reached something interesting, and we'll test that case more often than we would with random testing where we don't have any bias towards low values necessarily or towards that. And if we're generating our random values by like flipping individual bits or something like that, you know, then we'll, or adding one, that sort of thing, those sorts of mutations will tend to stay closer, and we can, that's something we probably would do for coverage-guided testing, where you maybe wouldn't do that for random testing. And I'd say example three is also helped by coverage testing because, you know, once we figure out that A equals 10325 is a useful path, we'll start testing things with that. Whereas we were just generating random tests, we probably never, you know, we probably generate that value once, not generate the right value for B, and kind of almost never hit the combined case. Whereas coverage testing, we'll realize, oh, we're partly there, we should keep going. So my hope is we'll have an assignment that's next week's assignment where we'll use a fuzzer that uses this strategy. So there's a well-known tool called American Fuzzy Lop. That's a breed of rabbit it's named after. And it uses this strategy. And the way it works is that you have to compile your program with a wrapper for GCC or client. And the wrapper just uses a diff assembler that basically adds this kind of assembly code equivalent to this to every conditional jump and call. Then it just says, we'll take a hash of the place the jump went from and to, and add this to a big array counter, and this is our coverage information. Yes, because it's a hash, we might think that two things are the same, but it's very rare. And this is efficient. And the idea is that they try to generate kind of just a set of unique test cases, unique meaning that the coverage array value when the test case finishes is the same. And they try to base the new test cases on the old ones to take advantage of that. We found how to reach a bunch of the code. Let's see if that helps us reach more of the code. And it uses a whole bunch of strategies that are kind of guesses, because this is all kind of semi-random testing. So one thing that does is that they just say, well, rather than just doing something's randomly, we should like try to flip every bit of the input, see what happens, see if that covers any new branches. try to replace every byte with all zeros or all ones, see what happens. And then just try a bunch of strategies where rather than generating a fully random value, we take an existing value and make small changes to it and see if that affects the coverage array. And if it does, we add that to our set of tests to base new tests off of. Some questions? This idea. Now, the other thing having this kind of coverage picture lets us do that AFL does is simplifying test cases. So, for example, here I have an array that we can go out of bounds of. And maybe we find a crash like this. But we really want to minimize that. And AFL does this by just trying, by taking our bad crash and trying to systematically remove things from it. So if this is our input, it's going to try removing every single character and see, does the coverage array change? And try decrementing every byte to say, does the coverage array change? Does it really matter that this is C or not? And basically, we get to that kind of, this kind of canonical version. And it not only does this when reporting, like, here's a crash to you, it does this as it's testing, because the problem with kind of random testing, like, of this sort, where we take an initial test and keep changing it, is our test can get huge and ugly. So it does this when it finds something that covers a different thing, it simplifies it to try to make the test case as simple, as small, importantly, so it's faster as possible. And another practical thing is, we mentioned this issue of, you know, when we're testing like HTML generation, how are we ever going to generate like a new tag or something like that? So to enable cases like this, there's a bunch of things that AFL supports, like, because, you know, it's been used to test a lot of real software, and there's things they needed to fix up to make the test cases practical. So one is, it supports a dictionary of, these are things that that we should try to put in the input because they're useful to test. So for like HTML, that would be HTML tags. For like SQL, it would be like the SQL keywords. Because these are things we're not going to generate by flipping random bits very much, but they sure are useful to like put select or from in your SQL testing. Also, we can supply explicit templates, like, here's something I know is an input that I'd like you to start with and try to change it to run other code. Or you can supply some post-processing. So something which happens a bunch is, like, we'll have an image with, like, a checksum to make sure it's not corrupted. If we do random testing on that, it's just going to fail the checksum almost all the time. So a fix for that is we'll post-process it to, like, change that checksum to like actually match up. Some questions on this? So this is sort of coverage guided testing. So as I said, reassignment. And we'll talk about a more systematic strategy kind of as our topic next time, that of symbolic execution, where rather than just measuring did the branch get reached or not, we'll kind of look at what the code is doing and try to solve, how do I make this branch condition true? Kind of what we were doing by hand when you said, oh, to test that function, you should put an open bracket in the first character. We'll look at how can we have that process be automated so we can have, you know, tests more systematically explore all the possibilities to hopefully find interesting cases. So that's where I'll finish up today.